Nome, also in August of 1899. 3 years later, and 8,000 people that week leave the town, and it subsides from then into its long decline. Another thing that struck me was that it was a story that had the right climaxes at the right time. If you're writing a novel, as some of you know, a novel must build, and it sinks, and it builds again, and so on, and there is turning points and corners. The Stampede has all these things, especially at the end. Several things happen at the end which are really quite bizarre and quite allegorical. First of all, you had in the spring of 99, Father Judge, the saint of Dawson, who had earned the respect of everybody because he owned nothing and did not care for himself but only for others. This Christ figure in the hospital under the hill, quite obviously dying as an act of sacrifice for this town. And everybody knew that. He worked so hard that he killed himself, really. He gave up his bed for people who had typhoid. He slept in a corner with one blanket under the stairs. He owned nothing. They tried to give him a suit of clothes as a gift on Christmas Eve at the Tivoli Theater, and the whole town turned out for this occasion. He wouldn't wear it. That's the first thing. Then you had this really weird story of the Nigger Jim Stampede, in which Nigger Jim Doherty, this crazy man with a bar and on a sled, decided to test this town. He invented the story of gold in a remote valley down the Yukon River. And he only told about three people. He wanted to see what would happen. And he started this crazy stampede in which 1,500 people rushed off in the dead of winter, ill-clothed, 60 below weather, maiming themselves for life in many cases, and really, in the space of about 5 days, reenacted in pantomime. And this takes you back to the medieval theater, really. Reenacted in pantomime the whole drama of the gold rush. The crazy dash down the river, climbing a miniature Chilkoot with their packs on their back bent double, hammering in their stakes and finding nothing because nothing was ever there. When they got back, Father Judge dies. And the whole town comes to a dead stop. Everybody wears black. And it gets colder. And you know what happens when it gets cold. The fog of winter descends. The chimney smoke goes straight up. The snow turns to sand and squeaks under the feet. It's as if a great ghost has laid a mantle over this strange, hellish little city. And they bury him, the man who owned nothing and wanted nothing, and then nothing would do but they paid $1,000 for a mahogany coffin, which is the greatest blasphemy of all. And when that was done, a tongue of flame shoots out from a dance hall, and suddenly the whole city is in flames. It's like hell. It's like Hades. And the irony is that the town council, this city of gold, has been too cheap to pay the firemen. So they've let the boilers, which kept the water warm so the hoses wouldn't freeze up, subside. And they have to chop a hole in the water, in the ice of the river, to get the hoses in. But when the water rushes through the hoses in the 60 below weather, it freezes before it reaches the nozzles, and the hoses rip open. And a moan goes up from the crowd, because they know that the town is doomed. 117 buildings demolished, including all of Dance Hall Row, all of Paradise Alley, where the prostitutes were, the major buildings in town. The end, really, of Dawson, as it was. Millions of dollars of damage. Strange scenes that night. I suppose the strangest and the most typical was when Bill McPhee rushed into the Pioneer Saloon, which was in flames, the oldest saloon in town where everybody had drunk, the most famous of all. Bill McPhee was from 40 Mile. He'd been in the country 10, 15 years before the gold rush. And Belinda Maloney said, "That's it, Bill, get the money," because the pokes of gold were stacked behind the bar like cordwood. And Bill McPhee said, "To hell with the money, I want my moose head." And he came rushing out to this huge moose head, which meant more to him than gold. It had hung over his bar all of his life. That's all he cared about. And the gold behind the bar and the gold in the Bank of Montreal safe, and the diamonds of the gamblers, the stick pins, and the necklaces of the dancing girls, and the nugget belts that the El Dorado kings had given away in their lust for status, all these were fused into one molten, useless mass. And the epitaph of the gold rush and of Dawson City, where I was born, was really uttered by Walter Washburn when he saw his famous opera house go up in flames. He stood with the others like people standing on the edge of the pit, and all he said was, "Well, that's the way I made it, and that's the way it's gone, so what the hell?" Thank you. Yes, sir.
I always wonder why we don't have anything unknown, similar to secondary to what you have done on the Klondike.
Well, there are quite a lot of books on the subject. I read about 200.
Yeah, but the secondary one, you know, the historical, not the personal account.
Well, my book wasn't a personal account because I wasn't there. It was a historical book. Oh, the Nome Gold Rush. I thought you said Nome. Yeah, I was saying at dinner tonight that there's a good book to be written about the Nome Gold Rush. It was the sequel to the Klondike. A lot of the people who were at the Klondike went on to Nome. Some very interesting people were there. Wyatt Earp was at Nome. He ran a saloon there. And Tex Rickard, who started in Dawson City, went down there and made a lot of money. And it didn't have quite the breadth of the Klondike Gold Rush. Was much easier to get to Nome. You could just go by boat. You didn't have to climb over passes, which was half the, not the fun, but half the interest of the Klondike. But certainly the Gold Rush atmosphere, the money atmosphere, was part of Nome. And there hasn't been that kind of a book written about it, no. There should be. Maybe somebody here will write it. Here. I think most of the material is in Alaska. Yes? Well, since that film was made, the technique has been used a lot in other films, not by me. I was interested in that because of the subject matter and because they asked me to do it, but I've got a lot to do besides films. But the technique has been used consistently since then. I've seen it over and over again. It always goes back. That was the first time, really, that technique, which was a technique of using the still picture as a moving picture, in which you move all over the still picture and examine it and switch from picture to picture, was successfully used. It was done by the film board, and it grew out of a series they did on Canadian artists in which they were examining paintings, and when they found this stack of, they found a greenhouse in Dawson which was made up of old photographic plates. I remember that greenhouse, it was there when I was there. And they tore it to pieces, and then and they made big low contrast negatives and made the film. No, I haven't thought of doing another one using that technique, but other people have. Yes.
What would be your advice to Alaskans who are talking about or perhaps dabbling in writing about Alaska in the early days as well as today, both from a historical point of view, a fictional, and just a factual magazine point of view? What would you tell them?
I think it's very important. Now, I'm not an expert in fiction, so I'll really stick to facts. I think it's really terribly important to find out really what went on and not what you think went on. And doing that, I think it's important not to try to twist the story. It doesn't need twisting. If it's a good story, it never needs to be told any way but the way it was. Don't try to embellish it. Don't try to add anything of your own to it, unless you're writing a novel. But if you're writing fact, if you're writing history, you have to exert some discipline upon yourself. Most true stories are more interesting than fictional stories, especially in this country. The great difficulty is to separate the tall stories, for which this country is justly known, from the true stories. I mean, when I wrote this book, I had an awful time. The first thing I did, I interviewed about 50 old-timers, but I didn't believe anything they told me. Until I could check it with documents, because people don't remember very well after 50 years. They don't remember what happened, they remember what they said happened, because they've been telling the story, you know, over 50 years, and it gets better every time. You have to be very careful with that kind of thing. And there's an awful lot of, you know, nonsense written about this country, and it's a lot of it's in print, and people steal from each other, and they quite often steal the nonsense instead of trying to find out the story behind the nonsense. It's often a much more interesting story. So that's the best advice I can get. Down there. I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
It took tremendous amount of food for them to pack. I mean, unbelievable amounts of meat that they had to do the packing. And I just wondered if you knew about how they ate and how they ate.
Well, what they mainly ate was beans, which is a high-protein thing. And they cooked them and then froze them. And I don't think there's anything better than beans, the little meat in them, but mainly beans. It's a very powerful high-protein vegetable with a lot of heat in it. And this was this and tea were the basis of what most people ate. They couldn't get much meat. Interestingly enough, if you only eat meat, it's not good enough. You have to have vegetables with it. If you're only going to eat meat, as the Eskimos know, or the people who live in Caribou know, you have to eat about four times as much meat as if you had vegetables with it. Yes?
All the pictures I've seen were probably taken in the spring and summer, but people are always dressed in derbies and suits and that type of dress, and I just wondered, how did they stay warm?
It's quite true. They dressed quite formally. This is the 90s, the Victorian age.
They used parkas?
No, they used fur coats and parkas. Oh, sure. No, they, in the wintertime, and there's lots of pictures, they dressed. The ones that came in didn't have parkas because they weren't known outside, the parka being a native costume. They came in Mackinac coats and heavy gauntlets and things. There were outfitters in Seattle making a killing, selling some bad and some good quality stuff to stampeders. Down there. You'd have to be a Canadian to understand that question. Oh, I don't always agree with Gordon, but I find him one of the most refreshing guys in Canada. He says what he thinks, and he says it bluntly, and I enjoy his company.
How do you view Alaska today in terms of what it's doing and what it sees it must do, or perhaps sees it must not do? What is your contemporary perspective of Alaska growing out of this knowledge and history of Alaska?
Perhaps it would be more diplomatic of me to talk about the Canadian North rather than the American North, because I know it better, and I don't like to come to a different country and give advice. But what we have to do in our North is watch it very carefully. You know, I walked over most of the Klondike, and every time I do, it's really with a sense of tragedy. Those beautiful hills, garlanded with white birches and maples, those lovely valleys, those rippling, clear streams have been destroyed forever by the dredges and the miners. Ground stripped of everything, brush, muck, wonderful topsoil washed down the Yukon River, every tree cut down to provide steam for the points when they were driving them. I wouldn't want to see much of the North destroyed and ravaged in the way that the miners ravaged the Klondike Valley. The last hope we have for breathing space, the last hope we have for the frontier is in this North country, whether it is American or Canadian. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't change when you cross the border yet. And I would hope that a very strict surveillance would be kept on the future. The first thing I would say is I don't think profit should enter into it. I don't think anybody necessarily has the right to drill a single oil well or dig a single mine in this country simply using profit as an excuse or wealth as an excuse. We've seen what wealth did in the Klondike. It didn't help anybody, really. I think we have to ask ourselves what's more important in the long run. A pleasant valley or a lot of gold, which goes back to Fort Knox or its equivalent. I think great sections of the north of my country has to be maintained as a national park area. I would especially say the Arctic coastline, a great section of it, and some of the Arctic islands must be kept for ecological reasons in their native state. I'm glad to see that our Prime Minister has been seconded by one of your senators, I think, and perhaps your governor, in his insistence on maintaining control over pollution in the Arctic. It's terribly important, especially in the north, where everything moves so slowly. We have in our part of the north what you have not got. We have the tundra, the barren ground, as Samuel Hearn, the explorer, called it. It is the most mysterious, most beautiful, most haunting part of the north, the great Arctic cold desert. But in the barren grounds where no tree lives, though the flowers that spangle the ground in the spring are like a Persian carpet, everything moves slowly. When Leopold McClintock was searching for the lost Franklin expedition on one of the Arctic islands across this tundra country covered in lichen and moss, he came across what he thought were fresh cart tracks. But he knew that those cart tracks had been left by Sir Edward Parry 30 years before. That is how slowly things grow to cover up or blur the ravaging hand of man in the north. Therefore, we have to move very gingerly in the north. We must not rush in and start grabbing and despoiling it simply for sudden, transitory gain. We must think of the long-term gain in the north that is far more important than tomorrow's stock market. Any more questions? No?
Before Mr. Burke sits down, we were talking tonight about someone else who might bring next year, and while my tenure as dean runs out in 2 months and 13 days, and I think I have certain prerogatives, I wonder how many here, just to kind of help